I'm just going to talk for about 20 minutes, but it's okay with you. About something I was trying to point out in the meditation. Because of self-ignorance, beginningless self-ignorance, it's not something, it's not our mistake. You're born into that self-ignorance just by the fact of having this body, mind, sense organs. That brings about a natural and beginningless, what we call anyonya adhyasa. Anyonya adhyasa, anyonya is anyonya, mutual. Anya means other, so other. So anyonya is mutual. Adhyasa is superimposition. There's a mutual superimposition that takes place. And the primary mutual superimposition, of course, is going to be on the part of the buddhi, because it's not on the part of the self, because the self is just pure conscious being. It's not engaged in any of these problems. You just simply are. Right. And you, that being that you are, is illumining ignorance and its effects, or it's illumining the buddhi with its ignorance and those effects, or the your atma, your me, is illumining ajnanam, you know, the buddhi that's suffering from ajnanam and those effects. The self is not doing anything. It's always the same. That's why prior to, during, and after self-knowledge, it's not that you've gained a new self. You've recognized the freedom of your own self. It's not a new self. You recognize yourself and that, I have always been free. I didn't know that. I didn't recognize that part of myself, that I'm free by nature. But it's the same self that you're recognizing is free. The one you thought was bound is free. See what I mean? So self is not involved in this problem. The problem, in terms of the suffering, are the ajnana. The ajnana belongs to the buddhi. And so the primary ajnana has to do, primary ignorance has to do with the relationship of who I am and who the upadis are. By upadi we mean whatever can take on the self, like this body is an upadi because I can say I am this body. It's my buddhi saying this, the body's not saying it. The body is basically inert. It has a sukshma sharira, subtle body, and so, you know, it's just accepting whatever the buddhi is telling it, really. So the buddhi feels, because of this reflects consciousness, because of the sukshma sharira, I am this body. Or I have sense organs, I am a seer, I am a hearer. Or I am my mind, I am in my emotions. That's all anyonya adhyasa, where the buddhi itself is taking me, the conscious being, to belong to it. And if it belongs to it, then it will say, and I am happy, sad, etc. Right? So the self becomes happy, sad, etc. Or it becomes a young person, old person, etc. You know, just whatever the buddhi is saying, having made that adhyasa. So the buddhi becomes the conscious being, and the conscious being becomes happy, sad, or whatever the qualities of the buddhi or any upadhi is. That's the mutual. Right? It's not that the self is suffering from mutual superimposition. The buddhi has kind of a two-way mutual superimposition where it becomes the conscious being, and becoming the conscious being me, has all these attributes. That's what we mean by the mutual. So that's our primary, the primary ignorance. But there's also an anyonya adhyasa that takes place kind of like a bouncing ball all the way down. And so what we were looking at is a twofold breaking of that anyonya adhyasa, on all really from the standpoint of your buddhi, which is the knowledge bearer. Right? The buddhi itself is innermost and aware of the manas. If we look at the mind as being made of the buddhi, that kind of the intellect, the deepest intellect, the knower, the ahankara, is also located in the buddhi. We have the buddhi, the ahankara, the I notion, the manas, the fluctuating mind, where we put all of the emotions, all of the negative emotions, and then the citta, the memory. So the buddhi is innermost to all of this because it's aware of the manas, it can talk to the manas, it can aware of the emotions, it can talk to the emotions, it can objectify the emotions, it can differentiate itself from the emotions. The emotions aren't doing that. What the emotions are doing is overwhelming the buddhi. Right? Not talking to the buddhi. It's overwhelming the buddhi. And when the buddhi is overwhelmed by the emotions, then the buddhi itself is functioning. It's like the manas has usurped the power of the buddhi. And the buddhi now becomes the voice of the manas. It becomes the voice of the emotion, or the voice of the misapprehension, or whatever. It becomes the voice of that which has overwhelmed it. And so the buddhi is continually getting overwhelmed, really, by the unconscious. Because emotions really come from the unconscious. The emotions isn't something that's created by the buddhi, you can't say, okay, now, just get really agitated right now. Get sad right now, you know. Now, these emotions are something that are triggered, you know. And when they are triggered, they overwhelm the buddhi, and now the buddhi and the manas become as though one. That's anyonya adhyasa, they become as though one. Okay? So now what has to happen, really, to get back to my normal self? Because when that happens, I'm not me, exactly. I am me overwhelmed by manas. The manas is speaking through the buddhi. You see what I mean? But it is not very hard once I understand it. And it also takes place in a split second for the buddhi to objectify the pain. All it takes is a statement. When it objectifies the pain, it's like saying, you're hurting. Now, hurting is objectified. Now, you're upset. I see that you're so upset. Buddhi is now separated. Right? Because it's just a words, really. I see that you're upset. I'm aware that you're upset. I'm aware that you're hurt. Let me help you. Let me be with you. You know, whatever way we do, we in the instant subject-object relationship has come. But to make that as kind of productive in terms of my knowledge as we would like, if the buddhi just learns, like we did in meditation, to own your knowledge, because the buddhi is the one that's either being overwhelmed or it's owning your knowledge. To own your knowledge is for the buddhi just to come back to itself, the self that you know. It's not just coming back, breaking away from the manas. That's not really enough. If that's effective, you know, just because we do it in psychology. But in Vedanta, we're adding something, another layer of knowledge. And that is where the buddhi comes back to its own being, which is the Atma. So I bring my buddhi back to me. And my nature is the nature of the inner friend. That's who I am, just by my very swabhava, by my very nature. It's not by my very nature, if I say inner friend, it's not like the self saying, okay, now let's be the inner friend. Inner friendness doesn't involve any words. It involves no duality. It is just the nature of Satchidananda, my being. My being, the being that you are, as when Swamiji says your heart has to be as big as Ishwara, he's talking about the buddhi. For Ishwara, the whole infinite creation rests in me, who am absolutely still. Ishwara has no ajnanam. He's not subject to being overwhelmed. Because infinite, you know, infinite being, not identified with anything in particular, everything being a manifestation of my own nature. Everything being maya, everything being mithya, without words, just simply is. There's no ajnanam there. It's not like Ishwara has to say, all of this is only mithya, there's no problem, you know. Or here's all these emotions happening, but I'm free of them. but the buddhi, which has beginningless ajnanam up until this point, has to bring the knowledge back, because we have spent beginningless lifetimes being totally overwhelmed by the upadis and the creation, right? And have been very naturally looking out here with our raga dvesha, looking out here to make ourselves happy in one way or another. It's just natural. Because I don't know myself as the source of ananda. And so sometimes You know, if I like something and that desire is resolved, I've experienced ananda. So it's kind of a natural logic. It's logical within samsara. It's logical minus that absolute knowledge. You know, what else am I going to say? Do this and do this and do this and you'll be happy. You know, that you're not happy for very long, then your mind will go, well, maybe if I also do this, this, and this, add that on, then I'll be happy. Then it'll say, well, that didn't last long enough because I didn't get rid of these things. It goes on and on and on for lifetimes, right? Okay. But once we've broken that ajnanam, now the buddhi, and I know myself, I recognize my own being, the purity of it, the changelessness of it, the ananda of it, not as some variegated bliss experiences on a continuum. Those are all different levels of shanti in the mind. But of that kind of indescribably simple beauty and well-being, or the simplicity and strength of just my own nature as conscious being. Whatever that is, we don't have it out here. It's my own self. So you have to recognize its purity just by your mind learning how to be directed toward that. And then you start to recognize that one that is never not there. And then you start to recognize what I'm like, the one who is never not there. And then these words make sense. Otherwise, the words are just theoretical. They have to land on this one me that's never not there. And then they all make sense, you understand. Because they're pointing to you. So that's knowledge, and that knowledge is myself. It's not a distance. I have knowledge over here and myself here. The knowledge is the direct, immediate knowledge, immediate recognition of myself, which is self-evident. I don't need a pramana for it. The knowledge is really just removing the ignorance that has caused this adhyasa, this anyonya adhyasa. So when I bring my mind back just to be with me, then the buddhi is a voice for me. Its nature is my nature. See what I mean? Because there's nothing overwhelming it. It's just like a clear glass mirror, something like that. Nothing's overwhelming it. I am its being, kind of like the clay of the pot. And nothing else is polluting it in one way or another. Mm. You know? Mm. And so now I gently can, like this, once I know, I just continue as a sadhana to just gently bring my mind back to me. And then I'm a normal person. Then I'm me, right? Otherwise, I'm an overwhelmed person, and the buddhi often has been so totally usurped in a way. I said once, I don't know if it was today or yesterday, I threw in that word psychosis. I did it for fun, but I meant it. I meant it like this. What we mean by psychosis, we have little mini psychosis when we're daydreaming, for instance. Say you're having a daydream, and then you're in the daydream. You're walking around in the daydream. You're having experiences in the daydream. That means your ego has been totally overwhelmed by the scene. But that's what a psychosis is. For a person in real time out here, is psychotic. It means that their ego has totally been consumed by whatever is going on in the manas, or in the psyche, in the unconscious, totally consumed. So now it's walking around in there, looking like in a dream. It's looking around in there and doesn't know how to get out. That's a psychosis. You see what I mean? And so sometimes the therapist, it's a difficult thing to handle, but the somehow you have to be able to guide that ego, so go in and get it, and bring it out. Like in shamanic practices, you have to go in, get that ego, and bring it out, because it's lost in there. And so we, in a very more simple way, it's not really a psychosis because we can come out of it, but we get lost. You know, in our emotion, in our daydream, in our jiva srishti. And we have to get that ego, that little conscious being, and pull it back to me, to my buddhi. You know? And when I'm myself, then issues, whether they're inside or outside, I can be with them. I can be helpful. I can care. I can be, you know, the friend, philosopher, and guide, as Swamiji will say, because I'm still here. Mm. Yeah. But the buddhi is more than still here, for if you have knowledge, the buddhi is me. It has me, I am itself, like the self of the pot is the clay. The self of the buddhi is me, not emotion, and not an emotion that's overwhelmed it. The emotion has overwhelmed the buddhi, then conscious being is lighting up, just by its nature, overwhelm. That's it. It's just lighting up overwhelm. And do you understand?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so then, if you yourself know how to, if the buddhi has been trained, based on knowledge, but also been trained through like practice, to just say these simple words, I know you're hurting. That's it. Then you can own yourself and take care. Otherwise, somebody else has to come and save you. Got it like that, you know. So, as we gain jnana nishta, right? So we call it jnana nishta. You have nishta clarity in your knowledge. It means the buddhi is always present as me, as myself. It's a voice for myself. That inner friendness is who I am. Because as emotions rise up, or as people, there's friction or whatever it is, instead of getting lost in the friction, I don't lose myself. And so then I can be with you. So if I don't lose myself, then I can be with you. And it's objective. It's the same inside and the same outside. If I lose myself, you know that because you're upset. It's very simple. It's not like you don't know. You're upset, okay. Then you have to do something, like say you're really upset. Tell me about that. What's going on? Yeah. And then you get yourself back. And the buddhi can be with me. And then I can be with the little one inside who's upset. Or if it doesn't require that, I can be with you as myself. Yeah. Otherwise, this idea of not being able to keep you outside. And we say, Swami says, you know, keep everybody outside. Let them have their own space. It means you be with them. Don't let them inside to kind of overwhelm your buddhi, right? Then you're not being with them. You're in a psychosis because both that relationship with its tension has been swallowed, has swallowed the buddhi, you know. And so then in that situation, you're taking either side of that. So that's why we do all these different ways of objectifying that, so I can just remain as myself. And it takes some time. To be with your knowledge long enough to gain that what we call like that mastery of not losing myself, you know, in the situations as they rise. Because initially, say as you start gaining clarity, you start gaining knowledge, old situations that were triggers will keep coming up. But they're not going to stop keeping up. They were triggers, and they continue to be triggers. The difference is that now they're coming up into your buddhi that has knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so now your buddhi becomes more and more able to be with them instead of being overwhelmed by them. Mm-hmm. And once you can be with them, then everything starts to change. Mm-hmm. Right? Because now you, who you are, is there in a helpful way to do whatever has been triggered or invoked. See what I mean? So it's a type of karma yoga, and only in the sense that we have to really learn in reference to our day-to-day life, you know, how to be with our day-to-day life in such a way that our knowledge and who we are becomes stronger and stronger, and until the world doesn't upset. The world doesn't upset the buddhi. The buddhi can deal with the world. Being me, I can be me in the world. That's a nice way to say it. I can just stay as me in the world. Is that good?
Well, when you're keeping others outside so you can be objective, they don't enter into you, you're also saying to do the same to your own reactions and your own perspectives.
Yeah, because that's to me, that's inner child work. Mm. So that's what I was trying to say, like when keeping the outside, because I didn't really get all of this. It took me a long time to understand what Swamiji was saying. But keeping outside means let the buddhi be in relationship, not be overwhelmed. Mm. If it's overwhelmed, they're inside of you.
Yeah.
And then you're walking around holding that hurt and that dyad, whatever has caused it. It's usually a dyad. You know? Both sides are in there, and doesn't matter if the person's on the other side of the world. Makes no difference. You're carrying that emotional pain. It's inside of you, walking around with it.
Well, that's the other person. Even if you're around the most wonderful people in the world, if you're having pain inside, you haven't kept it outside yet.
Yeah, but to keep it, when we say to keep it outside, means to be in a relationship with it, where I get to be me and then care for that pain.
So keep it outside means there's enough nishtha in the buddhi that you can continue. You've trained yourself to be able to stay objective and not get overwhelmed. So
yeah,
it's not like keeping people behind some shell that you're like not letting them into your life, and it's like
exactly
that's just like more.
More some soul
living.
That's why it took me so long to get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. What Swamiji meant, and it used to, when he would keep saying that, even to me personally, when I was having some problem, keep people outside. Now I totally understand that. It's very beautiful, but you have to. That's why language can be tricky. You have to really understand it.
What did you think when you heard him keep giving you the same answer?
Well, he didn't always give the same answer, but that was a phrase that didn't work for me. Mm. Other things he said worked for me, you know. Mm. But that one, and the thing is, he said it often enough in different contexts where I knew there was something that I wasn't getting. But I didn't know what it was, you know. It wasn't until a lot later that became, I knew what he was talking about, and then.
I don't know if this is a question or not, but you know, we develop ways of soothing ourselves when, you know, the world isn't really pleasing us too much. We can generate some pleasure by having a fantasy about something that would be nicer than whatever's going on.
Uh-huh.
And like you say, it often involves people, and that becomes a habit. And I'm wondering whether that is not keeping people up. That is bringing people inside when you have a fantasy that's populated by whoever, the person or the people. And so it almost, it seems like it would have to involve breaking a habit. Because that has been heretofore your way of soothing yourself.
The thing is, if you look at it like that, like what if the habit has no harm? We don't have to break all habits. We have lots of habits. But the habits can be benign. If they're benign hot habits, it's not a problem. But if it's a habit that you know is not good for you, then that's one we probably want to change. So say you have positive fantasies and you enjoy those fantasies, but they don't have any negative repercussions. Like say you have this positive fantasy that you love to have, but then that positive fantasy isn't taking place and going to take place in real time. Exactly. And so you're creating this beautiful positive fantasy that makes you unhappy because that fantasy isn't happening in real time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that fantasy maybe is not the best idea, because it's making you unhappy. Mm-hmm. You know, because the mind is so creative, it can have all kinds of fantasies and things, but are the fantasies okay, or are they an escape which has an aftermath? You know, like, say if you're tired and you lay down and listen to some music, or you go, you're stressed, and so you go for a walk in nature. Mm-hmm. There's nothing negative about that, you know. But the only thing is, I would say, is all of these ways that we, there's a lot of benign ways that we really, that are good for us. There's not a problem. But they shouldn't stop us from doing that work. That's all. Because we have our own ways and samsara of dealing, you know? But what if those ways supersede something that if you just spend a little time with, bringing your mind back to your knowledge, you know, your mind would naturally start to just enjoy a deeper level of shanti. That's the nishta. So we don't want our samsara ways, even the benign ones of soothing us, to supersede and stop us from learning these skills that are so in line with our knowledge and useful. See what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, you could practice those skills in the ashram, right? You don't have to go into the world to do this work.
No, don't think the ashram is easy.
Ashram is the world.
Ashram is the world condensed into a little small space.
Pressure cooker.
Yeah. It's a pressure cooker.
I have two questions. One is just to kind of play back what you're saying and see if I got it. You're talking about the Buddhi being like the voice of the inner friend, or the Buddhi is really, you know, me when it's clear. So is that the Buddhi is now has enough clarity of knowledge that it has it itself doesn't see itself as separate, it's fully identified with Atma? Okay.
Well, the mityatva of the Buddhi itself, you know, being an instrument, that mityatva is an obvious thing. That's known. But if the Buddhi is not lost in the manas or overwhelmed by anything, then just like the pot of the clay, the clay of the pot, your being that you are is not being overlaid by emotions or illusions. The Buddhi itself doesn't have any ajnanam, right? And so it's kind of clear. The Buddhi is clear. It's not contributing or changing your being.
Clear bucket of water.
Yeah, like a clear bucket of water it's never going to be changing your nature, but say your conscious being is illumining is an upset mind. Okay, that's what's being illumined. But what if the mind, the consciousness is not illumining an upset mind, it's illumining the Buddhi, which itself is in relationship to the manas. So the Buddhi remains as you, so to speak, even though it's all mithya, it all exists within maya, you know. But maya is not separate or doesn't have a separate being from consciousness. Does that make sense?
Yeah. My other question was, it kind of maybe seems obvious to answer, but so you're giving these examples of such and such comes up in the world, and here's how we deal with it. What about if we just don't wait for something to come up, we just go in and proactively find whatever wants to get work done and just start, you know,
well, that's what we do too.
Speed-walking, you know.
Right, if it's available to you, yeah, that's what we do. That's all that inner child work and spending that time, you know. It's not always available to you. Mm-hmm. When it's available to you inside or out, then it's there to be worked on.
Okay.
Or you can talk to it. Like sometimes I'll say, like, you can say, does anybody inside have anything to say? Or you can invite them. You can invite your unconscious to tell you some things, and then there it is for you to be with, you know.
You make this unconscious sound like it's a really a massive entity. I mean,
don't know any way of knowing how big it is. Because it's unconscious. But if you invoke it, we have no need to bring the entire unconscious of our entire unconscious into consciousness. Probably not possible. Mm. But there are, you know, complexes and traumas in there that are stored away from childhood that then project out onto the world and onto our buddhi and create a lot of pain. And so as those ones that are creating pain for us, because they're also doing lots of positive functions, all kinds of things.
Yeah.
It's the ones that are creating pain and also kind of changing my environment, changing my relationship with the world and with others. Those are asking for our help. You know, they project out, and then we're kind of lost in the projection, get lost in the projection, but they would love to have our help. You can tell that when you go in. And are with them and engage in that type of dialogue, then they feel like they have a way to come back into that libido, that being that they are, has a way to rejoin the conscious mind where they belong.
Well, they're glad somebody's caring.
Yeah. Just like out here, if somebody cares, it's a very nice thing.
You're using the word libido differently than common. You know, it's commonly used in the sexual context.
That's Freudian. If you use it in a more Jungian context, it just means psychic energy. And the energy that has been really, then we talk about in terms of, in a Jungian way, trauma and things like that, and complexes. It's as though some of that psychic energy has been swallowed. You know, it's like the trauma, the trauma, the emotion, the emotion, the dyad, the visual of the trauma with the consciousness has been sequestered, right? And that's why you can actually go in and dialogue with it, because there's a like a little shard of consciousness there, you know? So you can talk to those little ones, you can talk to the dyad, and it'll come back into, it'll rejoin your conscious mind. If those visuals work, it's kind of an imagery, but they use in thousands of years ago as the unconscious, they'll talk about kashayas, which are things that are kind of, they use the word in the unconscious, but they're like impurities that, and then they use the example like bubbles that are being held deep underwater.
Wow.
Yeah, that's the image they use. And so as you contemplate and as though like relax these, oh goodness, as you relax the bubbles come up to the surface, right? That's the image they use. So then they say you just allow that, just welcome it, you don't have to, but this is it, this is, you know, centuries ago, you just let it come up, welcome it, don't engage, and just let it go away. Well, those are easy ones.
What?
Those are easy. Those come up, and they'll come up, you can experience those kind of coming up in torrents even, and going away. It's just things that are kind of repressed and held down. They don't deal with kind of the deep trauma, structural problems, because I don't think they had them like we do. So we can do a little bit more.
That's why. That's why it's not there.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I used to ask Swamiji this, and I don't remember if he ever came up with anything, but it seemed to me that they didn't have a word for embarrassment. Is there a word for embarrassment in Sanskrit?
No, we won't translate it as embarrassment. There's, I'll look for that word. There's like seven or eight what we call rasas that have to do with the different emotions. Like they will have envy of these realm, envy and jealousy and sadness, these type of things. But the two major ones that we suffer from in our era, according to Kohut, is shame and guilt.
Oh, and they're sort of like embarrassment.
Yeah, shame and guilt, because they have to do with real young things that happen at a young age because of not being mirrored enough.
Yeah. Because of not being
not
mirrored?
Not being mirrored enough.
Mirrored.
You know, like, what mirroring, again, is a psychological term, and it's in a normal, like, say, mother-child relationship, as the child goes, you know, making it, the mother will go,
right,
they'll meet,
exactly.
They'll match.
Yeah.
If the child is, so they call that mirroring.
Yeah.
If the child is upset, the mother will come and give the appropriate response to whatever the child is giving. And it's very fluid and natural. It's not like you think, well, the child is saying goo goo, I should say goo.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's absolutely natural and fluid. But what's happened as, you know, family structure, it's broken down, and there's a lot of different levels of hurt with mother that herself didn't get proper mirroring. So the structural breakdown in the psyche itself, and so that has to be cured. It's more hands-on than just bubbles coming up.
Well, the mirroring kind of breaks down, then she's not, she'll be mirroring her hurt onto the child.
Something like that, so that it's not fulfilling itself. And so what Jung will say is that, like, the archetypal structure, that, and when he uses archetypes, we're really talking about the instincts of the psyche, differentiating those instincts from the instincts of the physical body. So the archetypes are the natural instincts and inclinations of the psyche, and those, as the person grows, there's different needs, developmental needs, that need to be taken care of.
Yeah.
And so what happens as the social structure and family structure breaks down, and Dharma breaks down also, these developmental needs that are waiting to get their corresponding, you know, response, so that they can blossom, don't take place.
Yeah.
But we've found, and to me this is just Bhagavan's brilliance of always having something else you can do to take. When something breaks down, you can go to your plan B. Plan B is that now we can actually, as an adult, enter into our psyche and come into relationship with those developmental arrests, those little ones inside that need to be, those archetypes need to be triggered by appropriate response, and then they will continue to grow and develop, things that were held in arrest.
And everyone suffers from this calamity, right? I mean,
everybody suffers to different degrees. It depends on, everybody has their own unique background. And for everybody, oh, I got these things and didn't get these, and you got these things and didn't get these. And sometimes the backgrounds were much more traumatic for some than for others.
So if you're with someone and you see that their buddhi is getting overwhelmed, can you use the same sort of thing, not say it out loud, but say it to yourself, like, oh, I see that you're hurting. Does that give you the objectivity in the same way to be with them?
I think it does. That's just bringing your knowledge to the forefront instead of immediately finding yourself getting sucked in.
Yeah.
You know, you have some, it gives you some space. Yeah.
Because I can remember trying to figure out hurts when I, when I was growing up, and it would just bog me down. I didn't.
Because you have no idea what they are, where they come from, or what to do with them.
Yeah, didn't produce any fruits, but I was obsessed with working with that stuff.
Yeah.
No.
Usually all the child knows is they're hurting and somebody has to take care of it. To make it better, you know. Then if nobody comes and makes it better, that becomes worse. Yeah, it becomes worse. If somebody comes and makes it better, it goes away and there's no problem because it got what it needed, you know. Say you're really hurt or somebody did something and whatever, you're hurt and your mom or dad or somebody comes and is there with you and you cry and get all upset, but they understand, and then all of a sudden you get up and run away and everything's fine. You know?
Like,
but because you were able to resolve it in real time. But often, you know, that doesn't happen. It's like there's this big hurt and then there's nobody to help or nobody who cares. It just says, go to your room and you feel better. Then come out. Not now. You know what I mean?
Stop pouting, would you?
Yeah, whatever.
I'll give you something to really cry about.
Yeah. The great thing is that you can go in as the good father and good mother and give that child what it needed, and it will grow. You know, it's a beautiful thing, actually. Amazing. Amazing that that can actually happen.
Just like springtime?
Yeah. Om Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurubhyo Namaha Harihi Om.